Mitch and Emily Rails built Glenstone to share their extraordinary collection of modern and contemporary art. But they wanted to make this a different kind of museum, a blend of art, architecture, and nature.
It's not just about the objects that you see, it's truly an experience.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. It's not a new idea for very wealthy people to build a museum. In fact, it's pretty common. For example, in Potomac, Maryland, less than 20 miles from Washington, D.C., there's a place called Glenstone, founded by Mitch and Emily Rails. Technically, it's been around since 2006, but last fall it took a big leap forward. But what is Glenstone? It's an art museum. It boasts over 200 acres of grounds. It's private. It's free. Kids and chewing gum aren't allowed. That's a little controversial. They only allow a few hundred folks at a time. No pictures, no phones. But those are just a few of the rules and regulations. Don't get distracted by those shiny objects. They're after something different. We recently sat down with Emily Rails to find out what.
So Glenstone was conceived as a kind of timeless place. And we talk about it as a capsule in a way that when we look back at it, maybe a century from now or two centuries, you'll be able to get a very good read about what things were like in the 20th and 21st centuries. But for any kind of snapshot or moment in time to have legs, there also has to be references to antiquity, to classical forms. And we felt that having a place where kind of the anxieties and the kind of irritations of modern life kind of fall away. And we do that by placing you in nature. And that's the first thing that you encounter when you come to Glenstone is vast panoramic views of a restored landscape. And this is a very old idea, right? Like, we've been to national parks all around the country. There's also monuments all around the world that tap into this magic that is the natural world and use that to kind of prime your senses for an aesthetic experience.
In 2006, the museum opened in its first version, which was a much, much smaller space. It was basically a gallery space, about, 30,000 square feet, something like that, for the original space. It existed that way for a few years. Talk about the early version of Glenstone, you know, when it first began. What was it, and what were guests experiencing in those early years?
So in the beginning, the idea behind the original Charles Guathme-designed museum was simply a place where we could show our collection. And Mitch and I had been collecting for quite some time. He, before I entered his life, was an avid collector of abstract expressionist paintings and other sort of mid-century masterworks. And so this building was an annex, in a way, to show off parts of the collection that we wanted to share with the public. Now, at that point in time, it was very much a private collection that had specific, you know, hours on days when we could be open by appointment. So the thinking behind kind of the expansion was to evolve into a truly public-facing institution with amenities like a cafe and with a variety of different experiences that visitors could enjoy. But those early days were much more quiet, I suppose. We had maybe 10 to 50 visitors a day, depending on what year we were in. I mean, initially, we'd be lucky if we had 10 people come a week. And it was all made by appointment. People would call up and they would hear through maybe a friend of the family that there's this place that you can visit. But nobody knew about us, and we liked it that way.
that idea of the museum as a kind of a place of respite really is something that I think more places are trying to latch onto, especially now. You know, it's such a cliche to say the world is a hectic place and it's getting more so, but I think it is. And you guys embrace that in a very specific way. One of the ways that's most basic, and it'll be interesting to see if other museums really start to adopt this policy, is no phones, no cell phones, no photography. Was that something you had in your mind the whole time, that this would always be a policy because it's so counter to what the experience is you're wanting to offer visitors?
Yeah, no, it's that was a very difficult decision to stick to. I have always been a very strong believer that the best way to view a work of art is to stand in front of it, to really experience it, to let it saturate your senses. It's not the same as looking at a reproduction in a book, and it's certainly not the same as looking at something on a screen. And so our message to visitors is simply, if you're going to come here and take the time to have the full Glenstone experience, really, really have it in the sense that, you know, we designed it to be experienced directly in person, and we ask you to put your phones away, not because we're anti-technology, that's not the case. We have a website, we have social media, all of that, but there's no substitute for having that actual direct experience. This is not the way that many other museums have been operating, because people increasingly feel that they need to be with their phones and they need to capture things on their phones, either to upload immediately to their Instagram account or simply to record their presence at a museum with their friends and things like that. And so we are definitely different in that other museums have not really drawn this line in the sand. I know that certain other places like the DIA Center of the Arts, previously they had also said that no phones were allowed at the museum, but recently they changed that policy because they were getting pressure from their guests. I really hope that we can keep it a screen-free place as long as possible, because it does cut down on the chatter in the galleries. It makes for a much more contemplative experience. Also, you have fewer artwork incidents. People tend to back into things when they're trying to take a selfie. So I'm very concerned about the
practical reasoning behind it. Yeah, exactly.
Actually, it's as much practical as it is about the atmosphere and the sort of dynamic that happens within the galleries.
Being kind of your own thing, right? You exist kind of purposefully in this private space. Talk about Glenstone, maybe moving forward now that you kind of have this modern museum complex, but Glenstone's relationship to the broader museum world, meaning like, you know, where does it fit in the fabric of all the museums in the country? Are you pulling mostly from your private collection? Will you, you know, work more with other museums to loan out pieces from your collection and vice versa? You know, how do you kind of fit in the puzzle piece of the American museum landscape?
What's wonderful about 2019, as you're looking around the world, is that there are many more museums than ever before, and many different kinds of museums. So it's not just art museums. There's museums of almost anything under the sun. There's also museums that are located in remote areas, like Glenstone, or like one of our favorite museums in Japan, the Banesse House in Naoshima on this tiny island. There's also major museums in metropolitan areas, New York, of course, and almost every other big city. So I feel that as far as part of the ecosystem of museums, we're just one kind of particular perspective on how you can have an art experience. And I make this point because I don't want it to seem like we think that we're better than other museums, which is why we're doing things differently. It's just a different way, a slower way of appreciation of art. And that's what we hope to continue to give to our visitors. So as far as the collection, the foundation actually owns the bulk of the art collection. It's not a private collection, in fact. The work that we are now acquiring goes straight into the foundation, and it is owned by the foundation. So people often refer to us as a private collection or a private museum. That's actually not true. It is a foundation-owned entity. And so when we expanded, we really set out to create an institution for the ages that would last way beyond our lifetimes. And as far as lending policies, we've always been prolific lenders. At any given point in time, there could be 24 works out on loan to any number of museums or galleries. And we are very, very committed to the idea that art needs to be out there and living and breathing and doing its magic in the world and not stuck in storage. And so there's very few loan requests that we decline for that very reason. I really do believe that we want them in circulation.
So besides being one of the co-founders of the museum and one of the collectors, you're also the director of the museum and the curator of the museum. And you're also a mom, and you do many things. How do you kind of balance that? And I guess describe to us, like, what is a work week like at Glenstone for you? What are you kind of doing in any given week when you're working there?
Yeah, I wish there was an average week, but it's been a crazy year, you know? Like, last year we opened to the public, and I gave my first interview, I went on TV, like all these things that I'd never done before. So nothing's really typical yet. I don't know what baseline is for me, but it's all been super exciting, a great learning curve. But as far as my work day and how I divide my time, I spend a lot of time with my staff coming up with aspects of the programming that I feel are important for furthering this mission of creating a place where art can coexist with architecture and landscape, and that the people here understand that mission very deeply. And so I spent a lot of time with some of our youngest associates who are part of a program that we created called the Emerging Professionals Program. And these folks are typically right out of undergrad or graduate school, and they're starting to get their foot in the door in the museum field. What we've offered them here is a 2-year position where they spend a lot of time during the week with visitors, walking them through the galleries, explaining works of art to them, having conversations. And then on that fifth day, when we're not open to the public, they participate in workshops and they learn about what it takes to run a museum, from the archives to conservation to finance and HR. And this is our way of just kind of showing all the different aspects of a museum and how there are so many opportunities for young people just getting started. And so that is something I'm super, super passionate about, is mentoring young professionals in our field, because I don't feel that there's enough programs like this for those who are just starting out. I remember when I was just getting my start, I had to take several unpaid internships because there's very little opportunity out there for people who are interested in the arts. And generally speaking, the ones who get the jobs don't really need the money, because it's a position of privilege, right? If you're going to study art history in school. So this is also my way of kind of giving back to the art world. I wanted these young people to have a fully paid job with benefits, and that's what we give them here. So to answer your question, I spent a lot of time with staff with developing these programs. I look at the visitor stats. So we're trying to figure out now how many visitors we can comfortably accommodate in one day, given that
it's currently set about 400, right? Is that the current kind of ballpark?
Yeah. And so we're trying to figure out, like, if it's a snowy day, does that affect our attendance? If it's a sunny day, does that affect our attendance? What does our cafe sales look like on those days? And so we're just trying to understand if there are any levers we can pull to continually improve upon the experience that visitors get while they're here. And it's going to take about a year of operating before we're going to be able to draw any, like, real conclusions.
And knowing, you know, what your cap is to where you don't ruin the experience, right? You know, is it 500? Is it 706? Like, you're not, you know, getting those data points will be important, you know?
Exactly. And that's kind of what we're doing. We're gathering all the data. We're slotting it into a database and trying to figure out if we can start to see trends.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the Humidity Machine. It's not the heat, it's the humidity. As any number of nitwits will point out during any given heat wave happening anywhere, and yet, tis true, dear listener, tis true. Humidity must be controlled here in museum land. It must be harnessed and held in place, monitored and mastered. Enter the Humidity Machine, which maintains just the right Goldilocks-worthy sweet spot between too damp and too dry. The Humidity Machine is always checking the climate patterns of our halls and galleries and always keeping them in check. And therefore, it is forever helping to keep the oil paintings from melting, the works on paper from flaking, the sculptures from sagging, the photographs from fading, and the mixed media from unmixing. The Humidity Machine keeps things on the level, round the clock, up and down, inward and outward, as steady as breathing. Namaste.
So your background is as a curator. You worked in commercial galleries. You know, you talked about internships. You had even experiences as a young person at the Guggenheim and other places. What, even before that, let's go way back. You know, did museums mean a lot to you as a kid? What were some of your earliest museum experiences?
I did not grow up going to a lot of museums or galleries. I grew up in Vancouver, Canada. And while there is an art scene there, it was not something that our family did a whole lot of. I went to like performances and I went to the ballet and things like that. But I didn't really encounter fine art until I went to college. And it was completely by accident that I stumbled into an art history class in my first year in college and just fell hook, line, and sinker for modern art. And I mean, the rest is history. So I really came at it from a very scholarly perspective, in fact.
And you mentioned, you know, your husband had been collecting early on, you know, a lot of abstract expressionist and post-World War II works. And then you came along and really brought in this contemporary perspective. And you can really see in the collection that's been put together and what you guys show this nice balance of those two things. But You're currently always looking out for, you know, the next big thing or who's exciting you in the world now. Because there are names in the collection that I wasn't familiar with, and I think one of the things I've read about some of the great praise for the institution is that it's this wonderful mix of those established artists, but also people that maybe aren't getting museum exposure yet.
Yeah.
How do you find that balance?
Right. Well, we were lucky that we had an opportunity to acquire some big names, icons like Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko and Agnes Martin, people like that. So we already had a very good foundation in terms of the most seminal works of art that are, you know, if not household names, pretty well known in the museum world. So currently, I would say that most of my attention has been turning to those under-recognized artists. And that's where a lot of very interesting opportunities can come up. Not as many as there used to be, because it seems like galleries seem to be very good at identifying a long-lost artist, you know, like the artists that emerged in the 1960s that never, for whatever reason, got a gallery show. So, but I think that it's important to shake up the canon. That's what curators need to be doing, and that's what curators are trained to do, is to look critically at the histories that we've been given or bequeathed. There's no such thing as a static history. We're making it as we go. And so it is our responsibility to be constantly questioning what's important, what is influential, and to be open to the possibility that there are other voices out there. And that this is also very top of mind across the country right now, is to see more diversity in the museum exhibitions that are up right now. Diversity in terms of ethnic diversity, racial diversity, even in terms of medium diversity, because we recognize that in contemporary times, it's not simply paintings and sculptures anymore. Popular culture is as influential on artists as looking at, you know, ancient sculpture. So there needs to be a multiplicity of voices because it most accurately reflects our lives.
When you guys decided to really expand and become the institution that you are now. And you've been lucky enough to have amazing resources and the financial flexibility to kind of really, you could kind of do what you wanted to do. And you had this huge space, 230 acres. So you had this kind of blank canvas to say, what could Glenstone be at its, you know, at its, in its best form? When you had that blank page staring in front of you, was that a big sense of anxiety that, you know, we can almost do anything? So now, you know, having the opportunity to do anything means we don't know what to do. Or did you have a really focused idea from the beginning of where you were going to go?
We had a very clear idea. By the time we decided that we needed to build a new building, we had already come up with a document that is known as an architectural brief. And this is all the hopes and dreams of your building in written form that you send off to a number of architectural firms and say, are you interested in bidding for this job based on what you know? And so we had general square footage. We had functions that we knew we wanted to have in this building. For instance, whether it was office space or art storage or different kinds of amenities, all of that was listed. And so with those parameters, it was pretty clear to the architects what kind of building this was going to become. And one thing that really helped shape the conversations was that we, at the time, had begun to acquire room size installations. So, for instance, we had just acquired Robert Gober's untitled Dia installation, which was originally shown in 1992 at the Dia Center for the Arts in New York. And that really occupies an entire floor. And also it requires plumbing and it has special lighting and there's all these different kind of mechanical requirements for that.
This is the
room.
Space where you so walk into and it's like a nature scene. There's sinks with water flowing. It looks like you're in jail. There's all kinds of things going on.
Yeah. Exactly. And it has this like 360-degree wall mural that's hand-painted by a team of 8 people, and it takes 3 months to complete. And so there's so many different aspects. It's a very rich piece. But we knew already that we wanted this to have pride of place in the new building. And so that really informed the design of the building, because we knew we wanted these discrete spaces where you could essentially enter into another world that happens to be an art installation. Another example of that would be the Michael Heiser piece, where you're inside the museum and you open the door and suddenly you realize you're outside again and you're looking at a deep container that's filled with these giant massive beams. And this is a sculpture called Collapse by Michael Heiser. And it's like you're transported to the Mojave Desert, you know. And so there's these very immersive installations that are strung together in the building, and that defines your pathway through the space. So I think while we did have a lot of ideas about how the building would develop over time, it was these kind of artworks that anchored the composition and made it a lot easier to kind of see definition as the design went along.
As you look at where you are, you know, it's not even 6 months since the expansion opened. Is Glenstone, in terms of the space, finished? You know, are you just getting started? Do you see it growing more? Mm-hmm. Where is Glenstone 5, 10, 15 years from now? Is it going to be a very similar looking space and institution?
It's going to have the same feeling. The spirit of it will be the same. The mood will be the same. It won't be more crowded. We'll always keep it quiet because that's the experience that will become our signature. But we're not going to start building a whole, you know, campus of buildings here. What we started off with, which was this pristine landscape, is something that is essential to Glenstone. And we never want to install too many sculptures or have too many little pavilions dotted all over the property. That being said, it's possible that we might build one or two smaller buildings to house artworks, maybe in the woods, maybe on an adjoining property, things like that. We do have other functions that we are hoping to fulfill. For instance, one thing we didn't think of was a conservation lab for our painting and sculpture conservators to work in. So that is something that we're hoping to build sometime in the next 5 to 10 years. But these are not public-facing functions. So I guess as a visitor, you may not notice much change as time goes on. But hopefully the only thing you notice is that the trees are bigger and there's, Split Rocker continues to flower and look beautiful every spring. You have seen Split Rocker, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it in person. I can't wait to come visit and check it out. You guys live on the property. And so you have this museum there not too far from your house. We started a program last year that's been a really huge hit called Me Time Mondays. And we invite one person to come into our museum. And our museum is a 27-room mansion from 1927. And it's got 25 acres of gardens. It's kind of similar in a sense to what you guys have done there, except from a different era. But we invite one person to come in each month and have the whole museum and grounds to themselves all day, because museums are closed on Mondays mostly. And we're there working, and
right.
We thought, we're here working, and the building is just sitting there. And so we started that, and it kind of really speaks to the idea of people having this moment to decompress and all these things. You guys have this museum not too far away. Are there moments where you just have found yourself walking over there just to kind of do that for yourself?
That's a great question. I would say that until recently, I was always looking at it with a critical eye, like, oh, that clump of grass is out of place, or I see a little bit of trash on the ground, I need to pick it up, or that person doesn't have their shirt tails tucked in, that kind of nitpicky way of looking at a project when it's completed. But recently, like in the last maybe 8 weeks or so, my husband and I and our girls, we've started to walk around the property on sunny days, on the weekends, when we don't have a whole lot to do, and just kind of watching the people enjoy Glenstone. And there's nothing more rewarding than seeing people relax, sit on a bench, enjoy a cup of coffee at the cafe, or just simply exclaim their feelings when they're looking at an incredible work of art. And, it's not that I'm enjoying the fruits of my labor, it's I'm able to enjoy their enjoyment. It's like a vicarious enjoyment. And I suppose that would be kind of my way of sitting back and appreciating everything that we've accomplished.
That is Emily Rails of Glenstone Museum in conversation with Jeff Martin here on Museum Confidential. More about Glenstone is at glenstone.org. And that's, by the way, G-L-E-N-S-T-O-N-E, Glenstone. And now, with Valentine's Day just recently behind us, Jeff offers a Valentine of sorts to his co-workers, that is, the fellow staffers at the museum where he's been employed for the last decade or so.
I never intended to work in a museum. It wasn't on my radar in my life plan or anything resembling a career path. What path? About 10 years ago, I fell into the museum world, and now it's hard to imagine my life before it or even outside of it. I've only really had two other jobs in my life, one at a video store in high school in the era of VHS tapes, and the other in a bookshop before the Great Recession. But here we are. I was in my late 20s when I started at the museum, and the second youngest person on my team. Now, I'm nearing 40, and I'm the oldest. A lot has happened in those 10 years. Births, deaths, illnesses, weddings, and all of the other bold-lettered happenings that mark a life. But God, have we had fun. My little crew at the museum has changed personnel from time to time, but we have a consistent core. Don't believe anyone who tells you that productivity and joy are mutually exclusive. That's nonsense. We laugh every day. Sure, there's the occasional argument, but even those moments have a little levity here and there. I'd like to mention my most beloved team members by name, but I'm honestly unsure of what the employee handbook says about such pronouncements. But they know who they are, from A to Z. I'll be honest, sometimes when we're having one of our best moments, when the room is bursting with creativity and laughter and collaboration of the best kind, I step outside myself and acknowledge that it won't always be this way. Nothing lasts forever. I'm not naive about that. But I try not to think about it very much. Better to be there with them. This all sounds so corny, and I'm sure you're thinking, sure, I'd have fun too if I got to work at a place like that all day. And that's partially true. The place is amazing, but the people make it different. At the end of the movie Stand By Me, the narrator sits at a computer and types the words, I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12. Does anyone? Well, sometimes, if you're lucky, the answer is yes.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me. Stand by me.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.